Welcome to A Certain Age, a show for women who are unafraid to age out loud. If you've been tuning into A Certain Age for a while, you know my day job is helping executives and business owners create strong LinkedIn profiles. I also teach classes on LinkedIn and job hunting. When I teach, I share examples of strong, door-opening LinkedIn headlines. Ad executive Cindy Gallup has the most eye-catching headline on LinkedIn. Her headline reads, "I like to blow shit up. I am the Michael Bay of business." Boom. Talk about a scroll stopper, but not exactly a headline to get you hired. The second best headline on LinkedIn might be by award-winning copywriter Laura Belgray. Her headline reads, "I write the only newsletter anyone opens anymore." As somebody who writes a newsletter every Thursday, this is exactly the type of headline that would have me throwing gobs of cash at Laura. That is, if I could afford her, or if she were still writing ad copy. Laura hung up her copywriter for hire hat after years of writing everything from TV promos for Bravo, Nickelodeon, HBO, to ad copy for woo-woo internet life coaches. Her words, not mine. Now she is an online entrepreneur selling courses that have helped thousands of business owners find the words and take the actions that get them paid to be 100% themselves. She began her copy career as a contributor to that Gen X Bible, The Preppy Handbook. She joins me today to talk about her own debut book, Tough Titties, on living your best life when you're the effing worst. So heads up, you late bloomers, wannabe writers, career switchers, accidental entrepreneurs, or simply people who love hilarious stories well told, stick around, because this show is for you. Welcome, Laura.
Hey, thank you so much. That was the best and absolutely most unique intro that I've heard. Yeah, I love it.
Oh my God. When the words LinkedIn came out of my mouth, you were probably like, am I on the right podcast? What's happening?
I was like, is this an ad for your, it should be.
Yes.
I'm into the fact that maybe it's that I'm susceptible to negging, but that I'm second best. It kind of gave me a little thrill.
That's so funny. Well, I can help you be first. You know, I do have a business in this. But I am really excited to have this conversation with you because I am one of the people that keeps opening up your emails. You are not wrong. And I've been opening them since, I think, like 2017, right? I'm an OG fan. And one of the things that I've learned from reading a bazillion of your emails is that nobody tells a story quite like you. So I do want to kick this over to you. I'd love for you to introduce yourself to A Certain Age listeners and kind of give us a quick career snapshot and tell us why you're here.
Oh gosh, a quick career snapshot. I mean,
you just wrote a 370-page book about it, so it might be a little tricky to trim it.
And it is the hardest thing for me to do is give a quick snapshot because, as you just mentioned, my career dates back to working for Lisa Birnbach, who was the writer of the Preppy Handbook, that Gen X Bible. And that was my first job out of college, other than being a bartender and being fired from being a bartender, which I spent the first year doing. So I worked for her as a fact checker, and that led me to Spy Magazine, where she was able to get me an internship that I would never have been able to get myself without that connection, because I had no qualifications or anything like that. And from there at Spy, I proved myself. It was like New York's coolest magazine, and I proved myself as the world's worst intern. I was just terrible at my job. I wasn't even on time, and I had to, like, one of my big jobs was to put together these gossip packs, like Xeroxing all the gossip pages of the different newspapers or gossip adjacent pages and stapling them together and collating them, putting them on editors' desks. And that I managed to do okay, although not first thing in the morning. The other thing we were expected to do as interns was pitch ideas. And they wanted us to grow into associate editors and then editors. And I came up with nothing throughout my 6 months there, zilch, zero. And the managing editor took me to lunch and had to tell me, you can take initiative here. And I was like, oh no. When you're told that you can take initiative, it's kind of, it shows that you have
it's
the
like
opposite of
you're screwing up.
Yeah.
You're on thin ice. You're on thin ice. That's the other eye.
Thin
right?
ice. Thin ice. Yes. Thin ice. It is the literal opposite of initiative. And I got lucky because the ad side and the editorial side were all on one floor, and I had spent most of my internship doing schmooze laps around the floor and just chatting to everybody. And so I got hired on the ad side. They were like, well, we'll take her. And that's where I wrote my first piece of copy. I didn't know what kind of writing I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to be some sort of writer or do something entertainment-y, but I didn't have a screenplay idea in me. I didn't have a novel in me. I didn't want to spend my days all lonely and, you know, weeping over a typewriter, which is what we would have used then, and crumpling up drafts and filling a wastebasket. And so I discovered there, they assigned me an advertorial, which for your listeners is that page in the magazine that looks like it's part of the magazine, but it's not really. And it was for Dewar's Scotch. And they assigned me, ironically, this whole page, it contained, this is the ironic part, an essay on adulthood, which I was still living in my parents' bedroom, but I managed to write that. And my parents' home, it was my childhood bedroom. It wasn't that bad that I was living, like sleeping at the foot of their bed. But anyway, and a quiz that was, the quiz was called, Do You Party Like Your Uncle Marty? And the quiz was to determine whether you were cool or an old fart loser. And if you were an old fart loser, then the remedy was to drink Dewars, of course.
I love
and
it.
So, yeah. And it was really fun for me to write. And then I had a whole page finally in the magazine. I was like, oh, I really like writing short, fun things. And that's called copywriting. And so I managed to carve out a copywriting career. The next place I went was another magazine that was way less fun and more buttoned up and corporate. And I lasted there a full 6 months before getting fired. And that was the only 9-to-5 I've ever had, those 6 months at that next magazine. And then I got into TV promos by the great luck of knowing someone from Spy who told me he was writing promo. We went to lunch and he told me about his new job writing promos for VH1. And I said, what are promos? And he said, well, I watch a lot of TV. And I write those short little things during the commercials that are for the network's shows that tell you to tune in. And I was like, oh my God, that's a job. I have to get that job. I always wanted to get paid to watch TV. That was my dream. And so this was some version of that. And he hooked me up with the editorial director, who was Lauren Zelaznik, who later would go on to create Queer Eye for The Straight Guy. And she was kind of the founder of what Bravo is now. But anyway, she assigned me a promo. It was the 90s. I feel like you could do this at that time, like go in cold with nothing really to show and get hired. And she assigned me a promo and I wrote my first promo. And then I went on to write a whole bunch more for them and write scripts for their countdown shows, like their top 20 countdowns and top 10 countdowns, some of them hosted by Moon Unit Zappa. There's some real Gen X name dropping here. Moon Unit was the originator of the Valley Girl voice on the song Valley Girl by Frank Zappa. So I segued into Nick at Night, Nickelodeon and Nick at Night, writing promos there. And that was like the place, the holy grail of promos for me. And I stayed in promos for years and years and years, at least 15, maybe 20-ish, overlapping with the online space. When I was around 40, I segued into writing for private clients in the online world, this weird kind of nebulous online space that I just called the space, online entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, massagepreneurs, doggypreneur, anything that you can a fixpreneur too.
Mompreneurs, right?
Mompreneurs.
I was a mompreneur a gazillion years
ago.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And now I'm a solopreneur. I still have preneur attached to everything I'm doing. I guess I'm a podcaster, not a podcastpreneur, but you know.
Yeah. You might be a podcastpreneur.
Maybe. I'm working up to that, Laura. Right now, I'm just a podcaster hanging out with a mic and having fun.
You can get that. If you monetize and scale it, you'll be a podcastpreneur. So, yeah. And that was by way of my friend Marie Forleo, who is one of the biggest names in the online motivational women's empowerment course creator space. That back then when I met her, she was a life coach and bartender, and we were in the same hip hop dance class at Crunch. And she eventually pulled me into this world, and I'm so grateful that she did. She asked me to give a talk at her first real in-person event, which was called Rich, Happy, and Hot Live. And it was in the Soho House Library to 50 people. So I gave a talk on non-sucky copy. And people started coming up to me after and asking me, like saying, I'm a realtor. Can you help me with my website copy? I'm a coach. I need help writing my about page. And I just started saying yes to them. Sure, I'll take new clients. And it was a totally different kind of copy than I had done before, but I knew that I could write in a conversational human way, which most people are unable to do because it's been drilled out of them by school and by if they work in corporate, especially for their or legal, they've been taught to write in a buttoned up, stiff, robotic way. So I knew I could do a better job than they could, and took on those clients, and that bloomed into a strictly online business over time.
I love it. And I've been following you since the Marie Forleo days, honestly, because I signed up for B-School, and because I get enthusiastic about things and I pay for them and then I get halfway through, I didn't make it all the way through B-School. I'm a B-School dropout. But one of the things that I've stuck with ever since is opening your emails and following your copywriting advice, because my career has been, sort of copywriting adjacent my whole life. And so I love what you're up to. We're heading into a break, but when we come back, I want to hear about your segue into writing a book.
Great.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Beauties, we all carry around different stressors, big and small. When we keep stress bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Sure, we can share our stress with our girlfriends or our spouses, but sometimes we need to give friends and family a break. Sometimes therapy is the better option. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever is weighing you down. I used therapy when I was a new mom, struggling with the exhaustion and overwhelm of new motherhood. Therapy was a chance to get my worries off my chest and to learn new coping tools. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapist anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/acertainage today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/acertainage.
I am Patty Callahan Henry.
I am Mary Kay Andrews.
I'm Kristen Harbell.
And I'm Christy Whitson Harvey.
Friends in Fiction is led by four longtime friends, the four of us, with more than 75 published books between us.
Through in-depth conversations and interviews, we discuss the books we've written, the books we're reading, and the art of storytelling.
We're here with endless stories to support indie bookstores, authors, librarians, and readers just like you.
We are always seeking innovative ways to introduce dynamic voices and trends in publishing.
On this channel, you will find hundreds of episodes with some of your favorite authors, including the four of us with our new releases, as we reveal the stories behind the stories, offer writing tips, and talk about the creation of novels, memoirs, and nonfiction titles.
So, if you love books and you're curious about the writing world, you are in the right place.
You can listen to Friends and Fiction on any major streaming platform.
Okay, Laura, we're back. We went into the break, and I just confessed that I dropped out of B school. And but I'm a committed student of your writing. I'm a committed student of your emails. And when I learned from your email, which is why it's so important to have an email list, that you were writing a book, I like raised my digital hand and I like DM'd you and sort of cyber stalked you on Instagram and said, please put me on your media list because I would love to hear about it when it's live. And the book is, you know, it's out. It's about to be on shelves. People can pre-order it right now. And I absolutely love this book, Tough Titties. It's a phenomenal read from start to finish. Part of the reason why I loved it so much is I was also a New York City kid who grew up in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, right? I connected with everything. Mm-hmm. I had that chocolate suit bag. I lived through the Upper East Side girl scene. You know, I also snuck into like Palladium, Lion Light, the Pyramid Club. And I've had multiple plates of French fries at Lucky Strike. So this book is not just a love letter to good writing and to amazing copy and hilarious stories. It's also a love letter, I think, to a vanishing New York. And I would love to hear about what made you write it.
Oh my gosh, I'm smiling so hard right now because it is rare that I get to talk to somebody who read it from that lens, like who was also a New Yorker and grew up in the same era and gets all that. Most of my readers, and I love this too, are like, oh, you make me feel as if I were there, as if I grew up there. And I get to see it all in studio and all those things. But this is really fun. I didn't know you had the chocolate soup bag.
By the way, I never made it to studio. Awesome. I was having like FOMO from the 80s. I'm like, listen, I was like lucky to make it into Palladium. They used to make me walk in with my friend Christina because I looked like 12 and she looked 22. And they were like, Christina is assigned to walk in with Katie because otherwise we're all getting kicked out. So I never made it to studio. That's a great chapter in the book. I felt like I was there.
Thank you. You're so much cooler than I am that you went to multiple clubs and actually got in. That was the only time I ever got in. And then I was quickly dragged out. So what made me write the book? I mean, it is a book of stories that I've always wanted to tell. And, you know, the thing is, I'm not a big famous person. So you don't get to just write a book of stories you always like to tell. And, you know, if you're not Rob Lowe, who gets to write stories I only tell my friends, or any other celebrity. I didn't have permission to do that. What I had permission to do, really, the book I was supposed to write was a copywriting book or a marketing book or something to do with business or self-help or personal development, some kind of how-to with like bullet points at the end of each chapter, what you just learned, your next steps. And I refuse to do that. I'm like, I would rather eat a bag of hair. And this is the book I always wanted to write. So the trick of it was giving it a theme, like making some sense of why am I telling all these stories and inserting some wisdom, some takeaways in a subtle way. I'm not going to spoon feed them like one of those books. But as for like naming it and deciding what the book was, because it took forever to do that. I was writing it for so many years before I finally figured out what was it. And by the way, the working title of it for a while was New Dork City.
Okay.
I still didn't know what it was going to be, but it was like a, you know, misfit dork in New York. A subtitle that I had once I came up with Tough Titties was Confessions of a Late Bloomer, but that felt a little soft and a little like flowery and didn't love that. But the title came to me because of something that I say all the time. I found myself saying, well, tough titties. And it's usually in response to something that somebody wants me to do or wants me to be. And I'm like, oh yeah, they want me to do that? Tough titties. And I felt like, okay, that kind of sums me up. It is the original ultimate sorry, not sorry, for not being a very supposed to person, in my view. And so it worked on that level, but also on the level of being basically 12 for life. And I felt like it had notes of that, you know, New York 1980s, like terry cloth halter top, sidewalks infused with urine.
Totally. Even if listeners are thinking like, oh, I didn't grow up with sidewalks infused with urine, like you did grow up with terry cloth. So like just do not pretend otherwise. We have seen your gym shorts from your 1980s pictures. So, and I feel like that it has that exactly. whole vibe of, I mean, I remember that, like people saying that, tough titties. It was just such a fun book to read. I loved every page of it, as I said. you know, but writing a book is no easy thing. I know that because I've been trying to write one for a couple years. And the hardest part is sitting down and doing it. So I'm just curious, like, what was the hardest chapter for you to write? Was there one that was easy that just poured out of you? Share what's a little bit of a backstory.
Yeah, I would say the hardest one, the easiest and hardest one for me to write was this chapter called Starfuckers, because the story itself, so that's the story of me and my two friends who were like my going out friends, they were my best friends at the time, truly like my 1990s going out friends, one of whom plucked my eyebrows into little like razor thin like pencil lines, and hey, it was the look. And the three of us met a world renowned filmmaker, auteur, who I call in the book, I call him Marty Scorsese, but he was not Marty Scorsese. It was one on that level, and it was, and so we just ended up in like a little bit of a mess with him because he wanted a foursome and we didn't feel like giving him one. And he was gross, but, so that story really poured out of me. It was a story that I dined off of for years. Like I came back from a trip where we had met him and talked about it and everybody loved the story. And then I told the follow-up story and everyone loved that story. And it was very easy to write. But then the hard thing was finding the why to that story. Like, why am I telling this? Why? How does it fit into this book of late bloomer stories, of trying to fit in, of, you know, those of not being the person that I'm expected to be, like going, taking the windy path to success. Like, those are the main themes of the book. And how does this story fit it? And that was a struggle with several of the stories. Like, I want to tell this, but I have to figure out why I'm telling it and weave that into the story so that the reader feels satisfied by it and doesn't just end up being like, okay, that's funny, but why are you telling me?
And so what did you learn about yourself with this sort of Starfucker story when you were peeling back the layers to figure out why you've been telling it all these years?
Yeah, I realized there's something to this, like, why do we put such a premium on celebrities? Why do we think they are so important? It's called Starfuckers. Like, why do we want that attention from a celebrity? What are we looking for? And I realized that, you know, my two friends, it was obvious. One of them was in film school. And so she was obsessed with this filmmaker, and the other was auditioning for acting roles at the time. She just started to be an actress. And so who knew, like, maybe he would cast her as in one of his movies. As for me, it's like, there was nothing concrete that he could give to me, but I was like, I want him to see me as special and tell me why I'm special and tell me what to do with my life. That's what I wanted from everyone, basically, but especially him. It's like, I want you to see my talent and tell me how to use it, because that was my big struggle at the time, like trying to figure out what career, what kind of job was going to harness, tap my talent, make me feel like I was doing work that didn't feel like work, and where my brilliance just shined through and everybody would recognize it and I could maybe be a wunderkind. And so that I was hoping, like, we were hanging out with him and I was just hoping he would turn to me and say, you know what you should do with your life? And then I would just be there to take notes.
Yeah, there's so much, you know, there's so much premium placed on this, like this notion of the wonder kid, like the, you know, like 40 under 40 list, in the sense, like, you've got to get it all figured out so early. And you know, you share in the book over and over again that you're a card-carrying late bloomer. You know, when I look at what you share in this book, also, though, you were on Sesame Street when you were two. You know, you're writing promos for some really big brands. You've done super cool things. Like, I mean, yes, like the Starfucker incident maybe, like, you know, wasn't quite your bag, but you, like, taught Sherman Helmsley, you know, the George Jefferson of TV to moonwalk. You know, so most people would think, like, that stuff's really cool and fun. You know, I get your career wasn't linear. I understand the monetary success came later, but I'm wondering, and I asked myself the same question, like, does growing up in New York City play any role in feeling dissatisfied? Because this is a hustle, hustle city where everyone's kind of A-list or blue chip, big successes, you know, the top of the heap. If you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. Do you think being a New Yorker contributed to your feeling that you hadn't gotten your act together fast enough?
It could be, because this was a time, you know, my 20s and 30s were a time before social media, before I could really compare myself to everybody in the world, which is now the fun thing that I get to do, like feel behind all kinds of people from all over the place that I don't know. So it could have to do with being in New York and where people have incredible opportunities. And if they have any hustles, they take advantage of them and really cash in on them. And I always felt like I semi did that. Like I was handed great opportunities, but I never felt like I maximized them because I wasn't built to maximize them. Like starting with that internship, I felt like I was running out the clock on it. Like, oh shoot, I still don't, like,
I'm still not on time. I still haven't gotten here at 9. Yeah. Shit, when's that going to happen?
Exactly. Right. Like tomorrow, I think I've always had this feeling, this wish, like tomorrow I'm going to wake up and be a different me and be an on-time person and be somebody who goes for it and does all the work and throws everything they can at their success. And I've never really felt like, except in moments, little isolated moments, I've never really felt like I was that person. And when I first started writing promos and I felt like, okay, I'm doing my dream job now, that's one of those moments where I felt obsessed with my work the way I wanted to. And like, I was working so hard that people would say, hey, do you ever take a break? I was like, are you talking to me? Cause that's not me. I was the break taker generally, but I do feel like it's been hard for me to channel that. Overall, I have moments of it, but I'm not built as someone who is all in and takes it to the max. And it's one reason I've never been able to, for instance, rise up the corporate ladder. I could not climb, you know, I lasted on that first rung of the corporate ladder for all of 6 months and then was like, bye-bye, you know, you can kick me off now. Because I don't anticipate the boss's needs. I don't hustle. I don't, you know, I don't get there early, if even on time. Yeah. And so, yeah, what were we going to say?
I was just going to say that when, you know, what you're saying right now, you know, you see in the book when you read it, there's sort of an evolution, I think, a little bit of an evolution in the way you see yourself. Like you were just sharing earlier about how you never saw yourself as somebody who was climbing that ladder or who could even. And you're waiting for Martin Scorsese to see your talent. But I, you know, in the book, you start to see your own talent. You start to see that you are doing things exactly the way you want to do them and succeeding with sort of a new definition of success. And one of the things that jumped out at me in the book was that both of your own parents made really big midlife career pivots. And that, you know, I imagine informed, you know, your own realization that it's totally possible to switch lanes, that you don't have to get it figured out right, you know, right from the jump, right out of college.
Yes, exactly. I mean, so my father, when I was pretty little, I'd say around 4, he switched careers from, he had been an industrial engineer for the airlines, for American Airlines, Eastern Airlines, which meant he mostly, I'm not sure exactly what he did. Part of it was tallying theft of those mini liquor bottles. but he got great perks. And so did we, you know, free travel, sometimes upgrades to first class. I was not old enough to appreciate that. But then, you know, when I was little, he switched to being a psychoanalyst and spent, by the way, so he was in his 40s by that time when he decided to make the switch. And then he spent 10 more years earning his PhD. I don't know how it took that long, but I am from late bloomer stock, let's just say, and slowpoke stock. So he took a long time to write his thesis, et cetera, and finally became an analyst. And, you know, I would have loved to have kept the travel perks instead of being probed all the way at my butthole for feelings constantly. What I did see in him was that relaxed timeline. Like, okay, you can switch, you can find your life's work in your 40s or later, because it was his life's work. He loved it so much that he always said he wanted to do it till his dying day. He never wanted to retire, and he basically didn't. He still had one client who visited him when he was in an assisted living place for a while, and came for appointments. And then my mom, partly inspired by him, I think, and pushed by him, nudged by him. She was in the recording industry and had a doctorate in musicology. So she had a PhD before he did. And she wanted to figure out her next step after having kids, her next chapter. And my dad urged her to read What Color Is Your Parachute and take a course. And this course in finding your thing led to an internship. And she discovered that she loved children's books. And she got an internship in children's book publishing, at a publishing house. And she was in her 40s, I think her late 40s. So can you imagine taking a job as an intern in your late 40s, especially back then?
Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't considered to be this sexy kind of reinvention. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do a TED talk about being a 40-year-old intern mojo.
Right. There was no way to monetize that step and turn it into a TED talk. Exactly. And so, it's a pretty humbling thing. She was getting people's coffee and making Xeroxes, et cetera, but eventually became a children's book editor and loves that work and loves children's books and is still involved in it to this day. In fact, she's involved with the Bank Street Children's Book Committee. And so I was encouraged by both of them that they had this relaxed timeline, and that was sort of the standard that I set for myself. Yeah, and
but their timeline was it was not even just that your timeline was relaxed. I have three kids, Laura. They're 22, 20, and 16. And I'm a recovering control freak. I learned in the first decade, I'm not in charge. I can help try to guide the ship, but the ship's it's got its own engine. The kids are doing their own thing, but it's still hard to kind of not want to help or push or guide. And your parents really were so relaxed about all the choices that you were making in your life. You talk about, good romantic choices, bad romantic choices. You're very honest. Your parents met somebody that you were having an affair with who was married. He was your former dance instructor. They seem super zen. And I was I wish Laura's dad was still alive to help me figure it out. Because, they're very, I was really amazed by how relaxed they were, during this, what you're calling the sort of late bloomer. Did you experience that, or am I just reading into that?
Well, they allowed it. But for one thing, that the year/years I spent loafing around the house in my childhood bedroom and not doing anything and not finding work, they were tolerant because they liked having me there. But they would constantly come into my room and say, how's the job search going? Any progress today? And I suppose less relaxed parents might have put down an ultimatum, you've got to find work or you're out of here, or you have to start contributing to the rent, which they didn't. And then when it came to the dance instructor, the married salsa instructor, I wouldn't say they were relaxed. I think they were gritting their teeth through it and trying not to be judgy. And I mean, my mom would, her voice would get very high whenever she talked about him. She would say, "So I guess he's separated?" Or
question mark?
Yeah, question
vocal
mark.
Fry, question mark, vocal fry, vocal fry.
Yeah. I hope, are you happy? and so, no, she was not relaxed about it. She was just really trying not to. I think they both understood that to push me wouldn't get them anywhere.
I love it. Well, they seem amazing people. And they're just, your family, like your love for them shines off the pages. It was really, it was so fun to read this book. You know, one of the things that I actually flagged, I wrote it down because it really jumped out at me. You said, you know, specifically talking about this sort of notion of late bloomer, the relaxed pace, the kind of the slowpoke notion that you referred to. You say, quote, my sloth-like pace has advantages. For one thing, I don't have to look back in my 20s, 30s, or early 40s and think that was the best I'll ever be. The plumpest my collagen will ever be, you bet. But my writing and career in life, still improving. I get to enjoy moving toward my peak. I hope I never hit it. Do you still have this attitude? Did aging play any role in getting you there? Or, you know, what role, if any, did midlife play in feeling really comfortable that you're running your own race at your own pace?
Yeah. Oh, listen, I do still feel behind all the time. I mean, and I think that's thanks to social media and the industry that I'm in or surrounded by, which are these online entrepreneurs who talk about scaling and are able to go from 1 million to 5 million to 10 million within a couple of years. And I'm just not that person. But I do think finding my groove, I don't know if it's because of aging, because of getting older and more mature, or it just took me that long. That's how long it took. It took how long it took for me to get there. And I do think that that's a benefit, not having to look back and say, oh, well, I really had my mojo back then. Like I peaked. I don't want to ever say like, that was the year I peaked. And be like talking about my successes from when I was 30, like, you know, the uncle who comes over and is talking about that goal, that touchdown he made
I know.
In college.
Right. Or you peak in high school. My daughter's always saying, right. Like, you don't want to ever hang out with people who peaked in high school.
Nope.
Which, you know, and we could say that for any phase of life. And you know, yeah, we want to be perennially curious and growth minded and doing new things. And like, how boring if it's like all behind us. Something that your book also really focuses on, too. I'd love to switch gears for a minute, if we can, and talk about your copywriting. So I've been talking about what an incredible writer you are. You've made a career, you know, writing for big brands, like entertainment brands. You've made a career helping other people market themselves and their businesses. You no longer really copywrite. You teach classes or sell programs that allow people, you know, to like learn how to fish for themselves, right? And one of the things that like really the hallmark to me, it seems, of your work is that it's, you know, just really conversational, talking in an own voice. I don't want to use the word authentic because authentic is probably like the most overused word on the internet. You call it more like being flawsome, you know, like how to like embrace your flaws. We don't have superpowers. We have so-so powers or loser powers. We can be flawsome. If somebody's listening to this thinking, you know, I want to, you know, share my writing better, I want to talk about my work, you know, how would you help somebody to become flossom?
I would say share the things that you don't want people to see in you, maybe. I don't mind bearing it all. And
the chapter on the blowjobs I gave in the 90s comes to mind.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to say that chapter wasn't flawsome. I'm going to say it was awesome. But okay, but back to being flawsome, please.
Thank you. So I love revealing things about myself that I'm insecure about, that I don't like about myself. Maybe it's some sort of strange proclivity of mine that I enjoy doing that. I think it's rare to enjoy that and people are afraid of it. Like, I don't want people to see this about me. I don't want to be judged for this flaw, you know, whether it's, or I don't want to look like I'm unprofessional. I think that if you are in perhaps in corporate or somebody who, or say you're a freelancer who depends on clients and they depend on you getting things in on time, you probably don't want to broadcast that you're terrible with deadlines and late with everything. That's probably not something, a flaw that you want to bear out there. But if you are in a position of sharing yourself and it's not going to compromise you professionally, I say go for it and share those things. It doesn't mean that you have to beat up on yourself all day, but I think that's the most interesting stuff. I kind of hate the word juicy, but it is the juiciest stuff.
I love juicy. I'm just going to jump right in. I use juicy all the time. I saw your post about juicy and I'm like, I'm sorry. I'm just I'm a lover of the word juicy. But, you know, but I get it. Like you, and by the way, I'm admitting that right now because that's how you connect with people. It's like you can't, no one wants to hang out with a shiny Instagram filter that's just pretending certain things. You have to just, you know, I don't know, accept who you are and be okay with it. And I think getting to midlife, I think that makes it a lot easier. And that's been sort of a theme of this show.
Yeah, I agree with you. It is the juicy stuff. Let's embrace juicy.
And Team Juicy.
Team Juicy. And when it comes to writing about that stuff and the craft of it, of making it good writing, to me, the secret is all in the details, the concrete details that you use, painting a picture rather than using vague, squishy language. Like, you know, I was in a dark place, loathing myself and where my self-esteem was at an all-time low. Like, what does that look like if you're talking about a moment like that? What does low place mean? It's way more effective to say, I sat on the floor for 3 days, like Demi Moore in St. Elmo's Fire, but stalking my ex on Facebook and eating Doritos from the bag and wearing dirty, unwashed sweats. Like just painting a picture, showing the details that we can see. That's what makes the writing gritty, makes it sticky, makes your eyes actually fix on it rather than sliding right over it.
Absolutely. So this is my last question for you because we're nearing the end of our time together. But you know, your writing does that. It brings it's vivid. It's story focused. You know, where do you land on ChatGPT? And because I know that everyone's wondering if ChatGPT is going to kill copywriting. Is it the killer app? I saw your recent social media post that you had a very funny experience when you were on a podcast recently where they used ChatGPT to try to create an introduction of you using your own voice. You know, is this the killer app? Does it really work? Is it ever going to replace real humans? What's your take?
I cannot imagine a world where it evolves to that place, because so far all I've seen is a fail in that sense of it trying to capture someone's voice, sound like them, do anything funny like anything remotely funny. Anytime you ask it to write something funny, it will talk about comedy. It will say, this is going to, you know, have you laughing your head off.
You'll be in stitches.
You'll be in stitches. This is better than a stand-up comedy routine. It could fill the arena. I mean, that's how it does funny, by talking about comedy. And it cannot, I mean, I gave it all the resources I could to make it come up with something in my voice, and there it came up with the word juicy, which I don't say.
Oh my God. It was using my language. That's so funny. Well, it's so interesting. So we can't use it to do, to be funny, to maybe to create connection, but we can use it to do our homework, I guess. So that's what people should be using it for, you know, for homework.
If you're allowed. Yeah. If you don't get caught. I know they're now like looking for that. They've got AI detectors, I think.
Oh my God.
But absolutely for structure, sure. Go ahead and use it. But someone said, hey, you know, I was struggling to write a press release for Tough Titties. And they were like, I will whip one out for you using ChatGPT. I'll show you how good it is. And it started, ladies and gentlemen, presenting the book of the year. Come on.
Oh, my God. All right. Okay. So it's not, we don't have to fire ourselves yet if we work in creative fields. It's not coming for us. All right, Laura.
No, I'm not concerned.
Good. You shouldn't be, because your writing is singular. And we need your voice. And we need your email. So everyone needs to like learn in a minute how to subscribe to them. But we are heading into our speed round. It's how we wrap the show. It's just 1 to 2 word answers so we can end on a high energy note. So let's do this. All right. Writing Tough Titties was?
Challenging.
Yes.
And challenging and joyful.
Nice. What is your most flossome loser power?
Being late.
It's been years since you've written a TV promo. What show on air today do you wish you could write a promo for?
Succession, but not Succession because it would be too hard and I couldn't do it justice, but Succession.
Oh my God, I'm so addicted. All right, please, for the love of God, stop using this word in your ad copy.
Juicy. Oh.
I knew that was coming. All right, not enough people think to use this fabulous word when they're trying to sell something.
I can't think of one that nobody uses. And if I can, I'm not going to tell you.
Okay, that's true. That's gold. All right. Ugh. When I see this email subject line, it makes my skin crawl.
My most vulnerable email ever.
Updating your LinkedIn headline to include the word author, Laura? Yes or no?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right? Why not?
So.
We got to bump you up to the number one spot, right? So we need to have a little magic on your LinkedIn headline.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll consult with you on that one.
I'm here. All right. Finally, your one word answer to complete the sentence: as I age, I feel
bad about my neck.
I'm sorry. Nora beat you to that. You can't use that one.
No, I blame her. I don't think I would have considered it. And it's now, I know I'm cheating. Like, that was, you wanted one word.
We're going to blame Nora Ephron and we're going to blame Zoom, right? Or maybe our phone cameras when we accidentally open them the wrong way.
For sure. It's a horror show. And I do blame her. Like, I don't know if I would have been aware that, like, what has happened to my neck. Had it not been for her essay, which is fantastic. Everyone should read that essay.
Exactly. Not if you want to feel good about your neck. So where can a certain age listeners find you, sign up for those emails that I keep raving about, find your book, Tough Titties, and just sort of stay abreast of all things Laura?
Yes. Okay. So first of all, on social, please come find me at Instagram. I'm at Laura Belgray. And then my site is talkingshrimp.com, and you should sign up for my emails at talkingshrimp.com/signup. And my book, Tough Titties, comes out June 13th. So if it's not yet June 13th, please, please, please pre-order it. And if it's past June 13th, please get it. Get more than one copy. Get it for your friends. It's at toughtittiesbook.com. All the booksellers are listed there, the main ones that count.
Thank you so much, Laura. This wraps A Certain Age, a show for women who are aging without apology. Before we say goodbye, two things. A quick thank you to everyone who's taken the time to write an Apple Podcast review. I see and appreciate you. And come follow the podcast sister account over on Instagram. You can find it at Let's Age Out Loud. The account spotlights even more stories of women making the most of midlife. Have a story that you want to share? Please head over to at Let's Age Out Loud to submit your story. We would love to feature you. Special thanks to Michael Mancini, who composed and produced our theme music. See you next time, and until then, age boldly, beauties.